Hey folks, welcome to Heartline. I'm Rita Schulte. I'm a licensed therapist in the Northern Virginia, D.C. area, and I'm passionate about matters of the heart. So the idea behind the podcast is simple. I want to check the pulse on your heart by taking a look at some of the cutting-edge issues that are affecting you and the people around you, and have you consider, how in the world is all this mess called life affecting your heart? To help stir things up, we're going to be talking to some of the leading professionals in the Christian counseling and literary industry, as well as hosting discussions with real people who are struggling with real life issues. If you want to know a little bit about me, you can check out my website at siftedaswheat.com, where you can ask questions, find out about my book, listen to other podcasts, or request to be a guest on the show. So let's get going on this journey of the heart.
Sex. It all seems great until the dreaded M word occurs. Marriage. Then the gates of heaven close and the battle begins. He wants it more, she wants it less. He likes it this way, she likes it that way. He says she never initiates, she says he initiates too much. So on and on we go until we wake up one day and realize the spark's gone out of our marriage. If you're tired of settling for a passionless relationship or mundane ho-hum sex, you've tuned into the right place. Because today, we're going to talk about sex and how to spice it up between the sheets. My guests today are Dr. Clifford and Joyce Penner. They are recognized sexual therapists, educators, and authors. Today, we're going to focus discussion around their book, The Way to Love Your Wife, Men Make the Difference, Women Keep It Interesting. In addition to their therapy practice, Penner's, Lowen, and Symington's, the Penners have available resources and seminars for healthy sexuality. You can visit their website at passionatecommitment.com for more info. Joyce is a registered nurse and clinical nurse specialist and holds a BS in nursing from the University of Washington. Her master's degree in psychosomatic nursing and nursing education is from UCLA. Clifford is a licensed clinical psychologist. He received a BA from Bethel College in St. Paul, Minnesota, and earned a master's in theology from Fuller Theological Seminary. He holds a PhD from Fuller's Graduate School of Psychology. And today, ding, 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 I'm going to give away a free copy of one of the Penner's books, The Way to Love Your Wife, Creating Greater Love and Passion in the Bedroom, to someone out there who goes to my website, siftedaswheat.com, and asks the most interesting question about our podcast today. Hit the Ask Rita link, or you can Facebook me through the link there. I'll decide the winner and send you the book. Now, Cliff and Joyce, welcome to Heartline.
Thank you.
We're very glad we're with you. So
yes.
Thank you.
Let's dive in.
Okay. Well, my first question is, why do you guys think that so often after marriage, couples' sex life starts to wax and wane?
Well, because the research shows that the brain chemical dopamine, which is the fuel of that passionate kind of new sex, needs to be replaced with the bonding brain chemical oxytocin, because the newness wears off within 6 to 30 months.
And since the newness wears off, the sexual relationship has to shift away from that adrenaline-driven attraction to the deep connection of commitment and intimacy, along with passion. And so making that shift is so hard for so many couples.
Yeah. So that's that heart connection.
Right, which is the passion that lasts 48 years like we have been married.
Oh my gosh, that is awesome.
Yes.
Well, you guys came up with 8 practical things that make up a great sexual relationship for married couples. And you say,
uh-huh,
the number one finding about sex is that men make the difference. Can you explain that?
Well, what we mean by men making the difference is that often the sexual relationship is how should we say, driven by men, or is fueled by the man's energy, and if he can be the loving, caring, connecting person and recognize that he's got to get to the woman's heart before he gets to her body, then that is going to make the difference for the two of them.
Or if he can give himself and adore her without making any demands sexually, then she'll open up to him and want him, and then he'll feel affirmed because she wants him.
Mm. So but it's that Christ, husbands love your wives as Christ loved the church. Well, how did Christ
absolutely
love the church? He laid his life down for the church.
Yep, and he never demanded we respond to his gift.
Yeah.
And so when a husband can love that way, or the other very clear example of this in Scripture is in the Song of Solomon, Solomon never initiates the sexual experience. All he does is affirm and cherish and tell her how much he likes this part of her and how gorgeous she is and how he likes this response. And then she gets all turned on and says, come on, let's go into the orchard and see if the pomegranates have blossomed.
But what so often happens in marriage is the man, rather than affirming and adoring her, it gets frustrated with how she isn't meeting his needs, and neediness drives the other person away. And sometimes this is reversed, where the wife is the one wanting it more and the husband gets driven away by her neediness. But that kind of neediness where you're not giving yourself like we're commanded to in 1 Corinthians chapter 7, but you're demanding or asking the other person to give themselves, and that never works. It works for us to give ourselves, but not to demand the other person give themselves.
Oh, that's what we mean by it has to start with the man.
And that's a hard thing, because don't you find that most men, I mean, if we're talking about love languages, their love language is physical touch, and so their idea of connecting with their spouse is through the sexual act.
Mm-hmm.
And
yep.
So, but what a woman needs sometimes is just to be held or cuddled or
affirmed.
Oh, he's wonderful. Yep.
Yes.
Yeah, and so that's part of that hard shift. A man has to give up his rights so that he can love, and then he gets his needs met. That's the interesting thing.
Philippians chapter 2 talks about Christ giving up his rights.
As God.
Then, yep. And then being elevated because he did.
Mm-hmm.
So that's the man's part, which is a big part, and often doesn't sound fair, and it isn't, and Christ's sacrifice for us wasn't fair. It does work, and men who are able to make that transition end up being very happy they did.
The second thing you mentioned is that a woman needs to affirm her sexuality. And this is a hard one in today's culture, because
very high on that.
Yeah, we have a distorted worldview of sexuality that sends most women the message, gee, I can never measure up to that. You know, what I find is that many women feel inadequate sexually because they see themselves competing with unrealistic standards out there and bombarded by TV, internet, magazines that show all these gorgeous women with perfect figures, and they oftentimes feel embarrassed about their bodies, and I think that hinders their sexuality.
Yes, and then when the husband places extra demand, then they feel like she isn't meeting his needs, then she feels even worse. So as he affirms her and she's able to affirm her sexuality and share it with him, that works so great. So she really has to get with and listen to her body desires rather than do it because, you know, it's been 3 days or I know he needs it.
Or it's been 3 weeks.
Right.
And what's important there is that the woman understand that there is nothing that turns on a man more than a turned on, responsive woman. And so her biggest gift to him is her being in touch with her own sexuality. And when she is, that really makes him feel good about himself. That's more important than an orgasm.
Mm.
And it may sound selfish on her part, but it really is the best gift she can give is by getting with her own sexuality.
How do you help a woman with that? I've had women that feel exactly what you're saying. They're very
They're
very shut down. They're not comfortable with their own bodies. They don't want their husband, oh, I've got cellulite, or I'm, you know, fat, or whatever is going on for them.
Well, I did a DVD that we have on our website that women can order on women embracing their sexuality that I did for the American Association of Christian Counselors. And that's very helpful for women to watch that and go through, because that's a whole nother hour talk. So,
but let's talk about just the core of that.
Yeah,
how does a woman get with her sexuality?
Mm-hmm.
Right. And starting with just listening to her body. And just even if they're little tingles, affirming those and thanking God for those. And
tingles of sexual sensation, even if it's not giant arousal.
Right. Well, what I have couples do sometimes is just practice non-sexual touch, like just touching one another to see what feels nice to one person, what feels nice to the other, so they get comfortable with just that.
Oh, yes, and that's what we do in our sexual retraining. That's clearly what they need to do. And we're talking here not about getting aroused. So many times women who haven't been with their sexuality and haven't gotten turned on, they keep thinking, oh, it's not working because I'm not getting aroused. And we're not talking about getting aroused. We're just talking about giving and receiving touch so that it's comfortable and feels good and she can enjoy it.
Yeah, and when a man or woman, but now particularly we're talking about the woman, when a woman can actually let herself experience the pleasure of the touch, arousal will be a natural of the way God made us.
Right. It'll be a natural outflow.
Exactly.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's what we mean by the woman has to be able to be in touch with her own sexuality. And then I think the third thing we talk about is she has to be able to lead. Is that
yeah, with her sexuality. And we find that when a man keeps his pace just slightly behind that of the woman's, so that both in intensity and activity, she leads, then she doesn't get shut down. And he doesn't get shut down by her leading if she does that with her sexuality, not with demand, but just by enjoying the process.
And that's often a hard thing for a woman to let herself do, because she somehow thinks he's supposed to lead. But when she can communicate to him where she is and keep it going, that actually worked well for both of them.
And the best way for her to do that really leads to our fifth point, which is true for both of them. Fourth point, which is true for both of them, and that is focusing on pleasure as the goal, not responses. And sometimes even the word pleasure may be too strong. It may just be comfort or closeness or connection, just that it feels good. And when that is mutual between the husband and wife and they can enjoy it and he can, again, shift toward her, it works so well. And that works best when they are focused on taking their time, and that's the fifth finding, is slow is better than fast. And couples can practice, both of them, taking time with each other and not focusing on the result, but rather on the process and just enjoying each other.
Yeah, that's a huge point, because I have so many women that come to me and just say, I just don't want sex. I don't enjoy it.
Right.
And I think it's because they have this idea of what that has to look like. Instead of just relaxing and enjoying it, it doesn't have to be the walls shake and fall in every time, but just the idea of connecting at the heart level as well through the sex act.
At that deep intimacy and closeness rather than the windows rattling because it's so exotic or exciting.
Or, you know, that one or the other partner is focusing on performance. Sometimes when there's sexual problems, I think the partners get so hung up on the performance piece that they miss all the stuff that you're saying.
Yes, and they start watching rather than being in the experience. And we always say, sex is not a spectator sport. It works a lot better when you're lost in it and just enjoy it. A couple of other things that we find help focus on the pleasure rather than the goal of arousal or release, and that's practicing touching in circles rather than straight lines.
That's particularly important for women, that in the touch that they receive from the man, that the man learns to touch in circles rather than in in vigorous straight lines.
That's interesting. Tell me about that.
Yeah, it just, there's just more of a relaxation that comes and an ability to soak in rather than the feeling of pressure that comes with a straight line touch.
Okay, let me ask you this, because, you know, back to this subject about women feeling about, you know, their bodies, they're embarrassed, they feel like they can never measure up. The question on everybody's mind is, what about my husband's battling pornography?
Okay.
My husband makes me feel more rejected and devalued and undesirable because he's going to pornography. Can you talk a little bit about that? I know that's got to be something you guys find all the
time. Well, we talk about that in this thing where we, in one of our points here, where we talk about needing to heal from past hurts or the junk we bring into our marriage. And this is one of those examples. When the woman feels like somehow she doesn't measure up because he is drawn to pornography, it, as you implied, can often make her feel pretty inadequate because there's no way she can measure up with those ID bodies and those spliced together movies.
That isn't real sex. That isn't. It's very exciting, and it triggers that brain chemical dopamine, which is very addicting and very elating and adrenaline-driven and powerful, and there's no way married sex will ever be like that.
So there's actually a physiological response, a dopamine response, which makes the pornography all the more addicting.
Yes, and that is the opposite of intimacy. So men who have been into, or women, we used to say we didn't ever see women who are addicted to pornography, but that's no longer the case. We do see women who are addicted to pornography also, but if they're into pornography, they usually have difficulty with intimacy. So not only does the spouse, in this case we're talking about the man addicted to pornography, not only does the wife feel the comparison and inadequacy, but she also senses his difficulty being intimate. She may not even know it, but there's something missing for her that she's longing for.
And so when we help a man get control of his sexual addiction and stop using pornography, we can't just leave it there. He also has to then learn how to be intimate with his wife, because pornography is, among other things, an intimacy problem.
Yeah, and I wanted you to talk about that. Is that, what do you think is the heart of that, Cliff? Is it an intimacy problem?
Yes, what we have come to believe is that they learned early, usually even in their adolescence, to respond to these external stimulations, but it isn't about a relationship, it's just about the titillation of the arousal.
It's external rather than internal.
And so when that's the case, then it is not it's not face to face, it's not soul to soul, it's using this external stimulation for the purpose of arousal, but it doesn't have to do with the hearts connecting. And so a man has to learn that as he gets control of his addiction. We can't just help him get control of the addiction. He now has to also go through some retraining to help him know how to be intimate.
Right. And figure out what his belief system is about that, maybe from the past, things that he's learned and fears that he's developed, which would hinder intimacy.
Absolutely. It's not that easy. I mean, it's hard to stop an addiction, but then it's also hard to learn to be intimate and make yourself vulnerable for that.
Sure.
And that is our sixth point in terms of healing from past hurts, and one of those is when one of them is hooked by addiction. Another one that a couple must heal from one of the spouses must heal from if they were raised in an alcoholic home. And people who were raised in alcoholic or emotionally out of control homes tend to resist getting into a sexual experience. It's not just a passive lack of desire, it's really a tenacious fighting it, because in sex, we are totally out of control. And an ACA,
adult child of an alcoholic,
needs control because their parents were out of control. or parent. And so to submit themselves to an experience where they're going to get out of control is very negative, aversive, and scary.
So one of the past hurts personality heal from is the addiction and whatever brought that on. When they're raised in the alcoholic home, in a third area is if there was any kind of sexual abuse in their past.
Right, that's what I was going to ask you about.
Or even physical abuse or emotional abuse in dating or in their home growing up.
But particularly if it happened when they were a child, what tends to occur is that before marriage, there might be a lot of desire, maybe even promiscuity, but then once marriage occurs, they tend to, the women in particular, sometimes the men, tend to, when they've been abused, they tend to then shut down on their sexual desire and not be able to go for it, because this is a conflicted part of their life, and they don't like the yes-no feelings inside them, that because their sexual feelings were stirred up in very wrong ways by a neighbor, a father, a cousin, a brother, whatever it may be. And so they don't have any natural, comfortable way to enjoy it. It's bad, and so they can get with it when it's bad outside of marriage. Bad, I'm using in the broad sense here. Wrong, but once it's in marriage, then very quickly they lose their interest.
They love, and somebody they love, they can't be sexual with that person, because being sexual with someone feels like being hurt. And
I think we need to be careful. I don't think we should say thought of. It's more
experience.
It felt that way.
Yeah.
Right.
Intellectually, they may know better, but experientially, it feels like it's wrong.
And that's why the sexual desire shuts down as they're approaching marriage or shortly after marriage for the person who was abused.
Do you think that people that have been abused, I know a lot of people that I've come into contact with, begin to act out sexually then and become promiscuous or do whatever because they're coming from a belief that says, this is what I have to do to get love, this is all I'm good for, this is what men want. Is that, do you find that's true?
That's often the case, but not usually having very much awareness about it inside themselves.
Mm-hmm.
They just find themselves engaged in this activity without a full understanding of
why they're doing that. But it is true that they usually have a lot of desire when they're not supposed to have sex, and then once they're supposed to have sex, it all shuts down.
Well, the next thing I wanted you guys to talk about is this idea of disturbing sexual requests. Some women aren't comfortable with certain things sexually, and their husbands may want to engage in things that they just don't feel comfortable with.
Okay, a lot of women
who've actually felt used and devalued in this area, and they've been made to feel like they're the problem, that they're prudish or unexciting because they don't want to, you know, hang from the ceiling every time they have sex. So how do you help couples with that?
That's usually a pornography influence.
It can, but sometimes it isn't a pornography influence. It's just that one of them wants to engage in something that the other one doesn't. Our basic principle is, since the primary goal in a sexual relationship is mutual fulfillment and the mutual expression of love, then we never do anything that violates one of the partners. So we never go against anyone in the sexual experience. And it may be that this person is just inhibited, that there's nothing wrong with what the other one wants. They just would like to engage in it. But then there may be, or it could be that there's something wrong with it. But either way, you never do anything that violates either one. So you always go with the most conservative member and look for ways to find joy and fulfillment with the limitations that are there. And then if there's things to grow and stretch about, that's great, but that has to be mutual. That's what the 1 Corinthians chapter 7 passage talks about so clearly. It has to be as good for one as it is for the other.
Do you find, though, that in the people, the spouse that, say, wants to have sex more or wants to do more exciting things begins to be resentful of their partner, and how do you help people through that?
Yes, definitely. And the one who wants it more gets anxious and then starts pursuing more, and then that causes the other one to increase their avoidance and their feeling of pressure, so they want it less, and so then it's a downward spiral.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and the other thing we notice there is that when a person is just focused on getting what is going to make them feel good, let's say it's the man pressuring the woman, that's more the stereotype. It can be the other way, but the stereotype is the man is pressuring the woman to engage in things that are uncomfortable for her. Obviously, then it becomes very much about him rather than about them, and then not only is that negative for her, but it also makes her lose interest and not feel loved, and so it's a downward spiral.
And that's where we would encourage them to start these 8 points with the man can make the difference.
Absolutely. You say people need to be intentional about sex, and I like that. It shows that it's a priority. But what do you do to help couples who can't agree about how much sex to have? Men usually want sex more than women, Cliff, like you said. So if he wants it 5 times a week and she only wants it twice, how do you help them navigate through that?
Well, first of all, we want to say that very often we deal with just the opposite, where the woman wants it more than the man.
There will be women listening to this who will be frustrated that we're putting it only from that side, because we get so many women saying, I'm very frustrated. Everybody talks about the man wanting it, and lately we've just been bombarded with emails from women whose husbands have lost interest.
Wow.
So, either way, what we always first try to do is find out, okay, what's going on for the other person that it's not something that's fulfilling for them?
Or desirable, or something that they look forward to, or anticipate positively.
And one of the things we usually check out there is testosterone level, because it is the testosterone that fuels desire and sexual interest. But then another example would be, if we're talking about a woman, if the woman isn't able to experience orgasm, she's going to lose interest in sex. If the woman doesn't feel loved and cared for and that her heart needs are met first, she's going to lose interest in sex. So there are usually reasons why one person is less interested than the other, and our first focus is always in finding out what's really going on. It is relatively rare that there's a big battle between a husband and a wife when both of them are totally fulfilled in their sexual experience and both of them totally desiring it, but one wants it once a week and one wants it 5 times a week. That rarely happens. Reason why the one who wants it less.
And the other thing is, many times the difference isn't that great. It might be that he wants it once or twice a week and she wants it 2 to 3 times a week. Well, there isn't that big a difference, but that little bit of difference may mean that she is initiating in this case and checking more often because she wants it slightly more often than he. And so if we have couples fill out a little form where they say how often would they like to have it and how often do they think their spouse would like to have it, and it's interesting the perception that is quite different that they have of each other. So just getting that clear can be a great start to working together on what they perceive as a big difference.
That's great.
Couples listening to do that.
Yeah, and I like what you say about the hormones, because that's one of the first thing I always say to my couples is get to the doctor, get to your GYN, get your hormones checked, and make sure medically everything's okay.
That's right.
And go from there, because a lot of people just don't realize that. And I think that's such a huge thing. If men aren't interested, a lot of times it's because they have low testosterone.
That's right.
And that can be fixed.
Yes.
Joyce has one more point that she needs to make, and that's the kissing point. So we don't want to get off the radio. I know our time is almost
gone. Oh, I love that idea. I told my husband that, and I'm trying to do that.
So I'm going to bail on you right now, but she's going to finish with that, and I want to thank you for having us, okay?
Oh, thank you, Cliff. I'm going to look you guys up when we get to Nashville. You guys at AACC this year?
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes. Uh-huh.
Awesome.
Good. We're in charge of the human sexuality track, so we'll be running around to those different presenters.
Oh, good. Okay, well, tell us about the kissing. Bye, Cliff. Thank you.
Okay, so we've been teaching for years now that kissing is the barometer of a good sexual relationship. And it was really interesting because about end of 2007, beginning of 2008, the research came out that totally validated what we've been teaching by our clinical observation. And it showed that passionate kissing is what keeps that part of the brain lit up where the dopamine comes from and keeps the spark going in the sexual relationship. And so couples who are wondering if they're going to be a good match before marriage, we always say, how's kissing for you? And if they love kissing, sex is likely to be good. And after marriage, so many times we stop kissing because now we can do the real thing, and so we don't kiss as much. And sometimes we stop kissing because the one who is less eager to have sex, and we'll talk about as the woman in this case, if the man husband approaches her and wants to kiss, she'll go through her mind and think, let's see, do I want to have sex tonight? And
absolutely, because she knows that's what it's going to lead to.
That's right.
Yeah,
that's right. And so then she just turns her cheek or gives a little peck. And so we have a formula for intimacy that we think is key for keeping this passion and spark alive throughout the marriage. And that is to spend 15 minutes a day connecting emotionally and spiritually and end with 5 to 30 seconds of passionate kissing that has nothing to do with whether or not you're going to have sex. And you talk about that ahead of time. When we kiss passionately, it's not a sign that I'm wanting to have sex. It's just a sign I'm connected and I want to kiss passionately. When couples keep kissing passionately on a daily basis, it's like keeping the pilot light on so that it's easier to turn up the flame. It is key to a positive sexual relationship lasting a lifetime.
Well, we're going to be practicing that, Joyce.
Good.
Thank you so much for your time today. I know how busy you guys are. I appreciate you taking the time out to do the interview. And God bless you, and hope to see you in Nashville.
Great. Thank you.
Okay.
Blessings to you.
All right. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
That's a wrap for our show today. Thanks so much for joining us. And remember, it's your heart. Keep it alive. Check the pulse.